listener. Hi, and welcome to Broadsheet Around Town. I'm Emma Joyce, features editor at Broadsheet. Today, we have a fine dining legend in the studio. He's been cooking for the best part of four decades. He's mentored chefs who've gone on to Michelin-starred restaurants overseas. And he's the most consistently awarded chef in Australia. I'm talking, of course, about Peter Gilmore, executive chef at Key and Bennelong. Gilmore was born in the Harbour City and started cooking professionally aged 16. He's driven by an obsession with and a passion for produce, from white sprouting broccoli to maitake mushrooms. He has a farm in Tasmania where he grows heirloom veggies and other fruits like apricots and cherries for use at the restaurant. He's an ambassador for a young chef competition, a whiskey brand, and for Australia's hospitality industry generally. He tells us about what inspires his menus and what a day looks like for him, sometimes racing between the two venues, and what challenges the industry is facing right now. We'll also hear about his love of yum cha, jazz, and the restaurants that he rates around the world. Hi, Peter. Thanks so much for joining us on Broadsheet Around Town. You've hopped in a cab from Key to come and talk to us in the studio, and I suspect you're going to have to hop back pretty quickly.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Just, you know, just duck down, do a podcast, come back to work. Pretty normal day.
You are the executive chef at two of the biggest restaurants in Sydney. Can you tell us a bit about what that means for your day to day? Like, how hands-on are you? Is your day, does your day have a rhythm to it that's relatively similar, or are you running across town doing podcasts all the time?
No, look, every day is different. And I think that's probably what I love about my job these days, is that I will spend time at Key and time at Bennelong. It's not necessarily scheduled. It's depending on what's happening, you know, what's happening with produce, what's happening with the menu, what's happening with staff. If we've got a big event on, it's, you know, I'm often at both places on the same day, and if not two or three times a day, and running in between the two. So,
have you perfected that journey?
I had this great idea when we first took over Bennelong 8 years ago. I was thinking, that's going to be really good. I'll get really fit because I'll walk between the two. But the reality is it's a 30-minute walk, and 30 minutes is precious.
That's dodging tourists as well, making sure you know when those ferries are coming in.
Oh, you could probably do it in 20 if you walk really fast, but it's actually easier just to jump in the car. It's like a 10-minute sort of trip in between, and I've got parking at both places. So, yeah, look, good intentions, but reality is time's precious.
It's good to know that you are there in the venue troubleshooting.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, you have to be. A big part of my job is the development and the concepts and the new menus and the new ideas for recipes and everything that is involved in that, right through from sourcing and training. So it is hands-on from that perspective, but also being in the venues, you can keep a pulse of what's happening. And it's surprising if you're not there for a little while, how things sometimes can change. You know, Chinese whispers, someone thinks you said, I want it this way, but I actually want it this way. So yeah, it is helpful to be there.
So in my mind, when you're saying that, I'm thinking of like the position of a fork, or like right down to the inside details of my, like the minutiae of a dish.
Yeah.
Is that accurate?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it is. It's more about the dish. I mean, I leave the front of house to our, you know, wonderful managers and, you know, I mean, of course I liaise with them and we agree on the order of service and things like that. But the most thing that I will do is those micro details about a recipe or a dish or the way something's going out. And things change all the time. So things come in and out of season or something wasn't available. So you need to be able to make decisions on the run as well.
Now, before we go into more detail about the fine dining restaurants that you manage, let's talk about something that people may or may not know about you. You're an avid gardener. You're also a micro farmer. Mm. So you have a kitchen garden at home and you also have this micro farm in Tasmania. Can you describe that Tasmanian location for us?
Yeah. Well, actually, it's not really, I wouldn't call it a micro farm. It is actually just...
Is it bigger than that?
Yeah. Well, no, it's not... a farm for actually supplying the restaurants. It's more of a, I call my test garden. Mm-hmm. It's also what I love to grow at home. When I get down to Tassie, which I try and do, you know, once every 6 weeks or so, I have a little break, get down there. That's quite new. But I've built eight garden beds and about to put a hothouse in, and I planted 50 fruit trees. The idea is that one day in the future, I may decide to retire to Tasmania. At the moment, it's an escape, it's a getaway. I spent a lot of time still in Sydney, but yeah. So really, it's sort of almost like a lab and inspiration for me, the garden down there. And in Sydney, I work with a couple of really good commercial farmers that actually supply the both restaurants. And it's surprising the amount of produce you need. I mean, I sometimes, you know, you hear of little restaurants that have got a couple of little beds out the back of there, and they say, you know, we're supplying our restaurant. Like, that would last half a service, you know, like seriously, you know. So it is on a scale that you need, and you need to work with a farmer that's passionate about growing in an organic, at least with organic principles. But it's acres of land that you need to supply a couple of restaurants.
What are on those fruit trees?
Tasmania has just got this beautiful climate. It's probably closer to a European climate. So it's allowed me to grow all this stone fruit. We're talking, you know, cherries, plums, apricots, all the way through heirloom apples, pears, quince, a lot of cold climate fruit. But it's surprising what you can grow down there. Like just recently, about a month ago, we're talking March, I harvested all my tomatoes. And the tomato season down in Tasmania is really late. Like when I grew tomatoes in Sydney, it would be all over by December. But down there, it doesn't really start till the end of February, early March. And it's that long ripening period. And they are the most beautiful tomatoes I've ever had. The flavor is just so much more intense because of that long, slow ripening. So, yeah, there's surprises like that that I found. I did not know that Tasmania was an amazing place to grow tomatoes, for example.
How are you eating that food at home? I know that you're obviously using the farm as a test kitchen for all sorts of inspiration for the restaurants, but how are you eating it when you just want to enjoy that tomato?
Absolutely.
Privately.
Yeah, sure. Well, actually, I brought a couple up with me to Sydney. And so this morning, my breakfast was basically a beautiful brandy wine tomato just sliced on some toast with some goat's feta and a little bit of balsamic vinegar and olive oil, a bit of pepper. Delicious. We made a fair bit of tomato sauce and soup when we were down in Tassie last week as well with all the tomatoes.
I ask you about all of these vegetables because you wrote a book in 2018 called From the Earth, and it's all about heirloom vegetables, vegetables that we potentially can't find very easily in supermarkets. Can you give us an example of what one of those heirloom vegetables would be?
Sure.
And the kind of the impact that it could potentially have on the diversity of food that we have available in supermarkets if we knew a bit more about them.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think supermarkets, if you look at where Australia was 15, 20 years ago, I remember you'd go into the supermarket and there'd be a couple of different types of potatoes, you know, pretty much dirty and washed, maybe two lettuces. So it has improved a lot, the diversity, but there's so much more out there. You know, sometimes the different heirloom vegetables might not be as commercially viable because they have a very short season. Maybe they're a bit harder to grow. Maybe the yield's not as big, but the flavor and the uniqueness and the quality is there in spades. So, you know, in the early days, I started doing this probably back in 2007, 2008. I planted a garden in my backyard, and then I started to realize just how many varieties, like even simple things like French breakfast radishes weren't available on the market. Place, which they are now, but all the different coloured carrots, you know, looking at something like Italian pink turnips that have this beautiful pink sort of almost starburst inside, you know, so visually, but not just, you know, do they look good, they also, you know, taste incredible. White sprouting broccoli, for example, so just really beautiful buds of this you know, in spring, and it's only around for maybe 4 weeks, which I love that because it's like a micro seasonal vegetable that you can look forward to every year.
It makes them extra special.
It does.
It means that, you know, I already get excited sometimes when I'm like, yes, mandarin season or whatever it is that comes around. I think it's especially important if we can seek out some of these vegetables that we potentially don't usually get to eat.
Yeah.
No. So I'm already thinking white sprouting broccoli. Where can I find this? When is it available? So I'm going to have to look at that up when you're gone.
Yeah. Yeah, well, like literally I have to get one of my growers. There's a company called Newcastle Greens. He has some fields up in about 3/4 of an hour outside of Newcastle. But he has acres of land, and I will actually get him to grow things like that for the restaurant specifically because it isn't available anywhere else. So you really either you grow it yourself or you have to find a farmer willing to grow it. And that I've spent the last sort of 15 years at least of my career doing that exact thing. We're working very closely with farmers, negotiating, okay, so I need these little blatter onions. They're a little beautiful Italian onion. They're about as big as a 10-cent piece, and they're beautiful and round and white and sweet. But I need 1,500 of those each week for key for a period of 7 weeks while that menu's on. So could you grow these for me? And you have to be prepared to pay an absolute premium to be able to get someone to do that for you because there's a lot of work, a lot of commitment.
What's their response usually?
Oh, look, in the early days, it was very hard. A lot of the traditional farmers, they just weren't interested. I remember going out and talking to a guy west of Sydney, and I asked him if he could grow purple carrots for me. And remembering this is like 15 years ago, and they just weren't available. And he just seriously looked at me and said, mate, carrots are orange. and I asked him if he could grow some peas because I wanted him to pick the flowers. I just wanted the pea flowers to use for garnish, and they're incredibly beautiful and sweet. And it was like, seriously, I'm going to plant a whole field of peas. When they're ready, I'll bring the machinery and we'll harvest them and that's it. I'm not going out every morning to pick pea flowers for you. You know?
Sometimes you need that really grounding experience and conversation with another person to say, look, mate, like what you're asking for is going to take a lot of effort, a lot of work, and potentially don't necessarily get to see the end result. Now, the diners at Key do get to see the end result, and what we see is so delicately, beautifully plated that often you don't really know what it is you're about to eat apart from what's written on the menu. Key is now in its 22nd year of receiving three hats, which has never happened before. It's unprecedented. There is an 8-course, a 6-course, and a 4-course option. I want to know, what are you introducing in the next menu, so the next seasonal variation of all those that will be on all of those courses?
Yeah. Well, the menu continually evolves, to be honest with you. I mean, we've just done a menu change because we're coming into autumn, you know, and there's new inspiration and new dishes, new ingredients. I've just, over the last year or so, these beautiful maitake mushrooms have been available from a grower down in Victoria, and they're a particularly beautiful mushroom that are native to Japan and a lot of Asia, but they've never been allowed to be grown in Australia before. We weren't able to import the spores, and just recently they changed the rules so we can import this. And these mushrooms are just absolutely gorgeous to eat. So when something like that comes around, you get really excited about it, and I'll build a whole dish around that idea to show off these mushrooms. So things like that.
And what's the benefit of having it grown in Australia?
Oh, well, I mean, the freshness, obviously. It doesn't have to be sprayed or treated as it comes into the country. We couldn't even actually import these mushrooms before. So I had several trips to Japan over the years and always loved some of the different produce. And that's true with travel. I mean, it's amazing, you know, when you get to see stuff that you don't have here and you sort of, that's when you hope you can sort of, you know, get things, you know, imported or, you know, at least get the seeds in. But that's becoming more and more difficult these days too. You know, there's a lot of regulations around that, and it's quite expensive to bring a new variety into the country. because of all the testing that needs to be done, which is fair enough. But yeah, yeah, it's good when it happens, though.
You mentioned traveling, and a big part of what you do involves eating at and being a diner at some of the best restaurants around the world. Can you think of any that are just particularly memorable?
Yeah, there's so many incredible restaurants out there, really. For me, over the last few years, I haven't done as much travel, obviously, with COVID, but last year I got to Italy, which was fantastic, and Lido 84 was a brilliant Italian restaurant I went to. Some of my favourite restaurants in Europe would be Mergaritz in Spain. Certainly, Noma is always innovative and still pushing boundaries. There are particularly exceptional sort of pilgrimage type restaurants like Blue Hills at Stone Barns in New York, just an hour out of New York City, is this incredible country restaurant. And the chef Dan Barber there just really sort of a very similar sort of idea of, you know, loving the idea of vegetables and varieties and heirloom. And he has a whole farm that pretty much grows all the produce for the restaurant. You know, so restaurants like that are just standouts and something that you just maybe only do once in your lifetime, but you're absolutely very memorable.
You've been cooking professionally since you were 16. It's almost four decades worth of experience that you've had working in professional kitchens. And as we've been talking about, dining in some of the best restaurants in the world, can you give us a kind of overview of any changes you've seen in the way people like to eat at fine dining restaurants?
Yeah. Look, I think the idea of what a fine dining restaurant was, say, 20 or 30 years ago was maybe something that was quite stuffy and, you know, sort of that French model of over-the-top service and maybe a little bit of attitude. And I think that is completely disappeared now. From cutting-edge top restaurants, there is a real sort of, you can feel the passion coming from the people that work there. They absolutely love what they do. And I think that the very best of those restaurants make the guests feel incredibly welcome and incredibly warm, especially, you know, some of the guests are brand new to that sort of dining. It might be a really special occasion. It might be, you know, their 20th wedding anniversary or something like that. And to make people feel at ease and relaxed and happy and excited to be there, I think is the biggest change in fine dining restaurants. It's more of an attitude change, I believe. But also it's a place where you can celebrate the absolute diversity of food and textures, techniques, and nature itself. And it is not just about having a meal. It's about having a really all-rounded experience.
There are so many things coming to mind that I want to tease out of there. One of them is, are you aware in advance and do you do anything in advance for when people come in for a special occasion?
Yeah, well, absolutely. There's a briefing every night with the waiters out the front of house. So certainly most restaurants, good restaurants, would do this. And, you know, every night at Key or Bennelong, the waiters will gather around and read out, like, who's coming in. Is there a special occasion? Is there any special requirements, any dietary requirements? Is someone a regular? Is someone been back for the third time this year? Should we do something special for them because they need to see something different? All of these things are always considered, every single service.
It's a lot to maintain this sort of special environment. Are there any aspects of it that you would never want to see die?
Look, I think it's getting harder, certainly in Australia, to operate restaurants on this level. I think that, you know, and it's probably the same in other countries around the world too. It's just the amount of labour that it actually takes to give this sort of experience is extraordinary. And the ratio of customers to staff is very high. I mean, at Key, we might do 80 people a night, but we've got at least 25 people on the floor and about the same in the kitchen. So, you know, we're looking at, you know, 50 staff members for 80 guests. Or, you know, at a minimum, it would be 40 So it's, you know, one for every two customers. So it is an extraordinarily expensive process. And, you know, and I think when people say, oh, gee, fine dining restaurants are expensive, I think if you actually looked at what the costs are, and the profit is very, very small compared to so many other businesses. And you have to rely on being full every night, that your diners actually turn up for their bookings. Because, you know, one table doesn't turn up at a restaurant, that's literally the profit for the night. It is, you're working on a knife's edge the whole time in this industry. And so there's less and less, I think, fine dining restaurants will open in the present climate anyway. But it is incredibly rewarding, I think, from a customer perspective, to go to these restaurants for a very special experience. When someone comes up to you and says, that was the meal of my life, then you know all the effort and everything that you've done is actually so worthwhile, because you've given someone not just a meal, you've given them a memory, you know, and that's what the business that we're in.
Do you think that summarizes what most restaurants are going through in Australia at the moment, kind of labor concerns, cost of living crisis generally, people cancelling at the last minute? Are there any other challenges in the hospitality industry generally that you think?
I think it's a more challenging time than it's ever been in the past. Certainly over the last, 30 odd years that I've been in business, I've never seen it quite as tightly squeezed as it is at the moment. And the surprising thing is new restaurants keep opening up. And, you know, so finding staff, the staff's pretty thin on the ground. New restaurants open, so older ones end up closing. You know, especially in Sydney, the idea of the new is always very attractive, it seems. You know, and I get that. But when a new restaurant opens and it's only open for a couple of years and then it goes broke, it's sort of like, it's really difficult for the whole industry that this cycle keep happening. It is a tough industry. And I think the biggest issue really we're facing is, cost of living. Everything has gone up so much in price, and we're all affected by that, of course. So I think especially the more medium marketplace restaurants are suffering quite badly at the moment, because, you know, those sort of restaurants that people go out to, and they might go out to that type of restaurant two times a week or three times a week, they're pulling back on those expenses, you know, eating at home. And it's understandable, but, you know, I don't know where that leaves the industry at the moment. Things probably need to change a little bit.
I'm going to pick up on you talking about the people that you work with, because not only do you need labor in the restaurants, but they need to be of the highest quality standard, really.
Yeah.
You have mentored so many people in your career. I know Annalise Gregory has been through your kitchen. We've got Rob Cockrell. Who else?
There's so many people over the years, especially, 22 years at Key, I've had so many chefs come through. Sam Abitt, he's got a restaurant now. He's working in Vietnam. I'm actually going to go over there in August and do a little collab sort of dinner with him, which will be fun. Jason Saxby, there's been so many young chefs that have come through, and I think these days young chefs get a lot of experience at different restaurants, and they get travel and they go to different restaurants around the world. And I think, you know, if someone's built up a career over, you know, say 10 years of training, hopefully they've been mentored by at least three or four really interesting, diverse chefs. So their accumulated knowledge is a part of all of those experiences that they've had. So then when they go to cook their own food and find out what is, you know, what they want to say about food and the type of food they want to produce, they've had this multi-layered experience to draw from.
Can you think of anything that maybe connects some of these youngsters who've been through your kitchen and have gone on to really incredible restaurants of their own here and overseas? Has there been anything that you've thought, I knew you'd have it?
Yeah. I think sometimes, you can really tell. I mean, it's an overused word, but passion is just something that is quite tangible. When you see a young chef, you know that you know, if they absolutely live for it, it's what they totally want to do with their life. And you can tell that, I think, within a couple of weeks of working with them, that they are incredibly passionate. They're the ones that I think, oh, well, you're definitely going to go places, because it's not just a job. It's much more than that. It's they have to do it, basically, to express whatever's inside them. And I think when you see that sort of passion, you think, okay, well, you're at least halfway there. You know, you've got the passion. Now you just got to get the experience, and then you've got to have the determination to stick it out. And all of the many attributes you need to have. I think you've also got to have a bit of natural curiosity and creativity, I think.
You're a judge and mentor for the Australian San Pellegrino Young Chef of the Year Awards. That's an awards that's for talented chefs aged between 18 and 30. As a judge, what are you looking for from these people?
Well, that particular competition is a great competition. There is regional finals, which would be in the sort of Australia-Pacific area, so Australia, New Zealand. And we have to select one finalist to represent our region. Then they go to Milan for the final, and they might be up against another sort of 15 chefs from different regions all around the world. So it's a really beautiful competition in the sense that it is actually an international competition. And, you know, the person that we are looking for is, you know, again, someone that has got something personal to say. I think it's something that maybe isn't just, they're not just reproducing trendy ideas or, you know, things they've read in books. There's actually a personal story behind their dish, something that they're incredibly passionate about. It might be part of their cultural background or a memory from childhood or just what they've discovered along their initial cooking journey and what they want to say on the plate.
I was looking at some of the previous winners. There hasn't been an Australian winner yet in the global competition. What do you think it takes for young chefs in Australia to get that global recognition?
Look, I think it is probably a little harder for us here in Australia. There is that tyranny of distance. I think if you're a chef in Europe, potentially you've got so many colleagues and other people in different industries in countries really close to you that can travel and experience what you're doing. And so there is that isolation, but I think that isolation also gives you an opportunity to produce something quite unique as well. I mean, these days, I think with social media and the way that recipes are shared and knowledge is shared around the world, you can pretty much see and do everything. Years ago, when I was a younger chef, if you wanted to learn about a chef from overseas, you'd have to buy his cookbook, you know, and then you'd study the cookbook and look at the recipes and try and imagine what it's like. And now you can pick up your phone, you can see what's on the menu tonight at Noma. Some of the chefs are posting their preparation techniques, and you know, it's very easy to get knowledge, and that can almost be to a detriment in the sense that everything gets a bit homogenized. Ideas float around the world so quickly and they get reproduced, where I think, you know, a little bit of isolation and drilling down on what is available in your area can give you a bit of an edge of uniqueness, especially when it comes to ingredients. So, look, Australia has just as much chance to win these young chef competitions as anyone in the world. This particular competition's only really been going for about 8 years. So, you know, with 15 different regions, it can't be too long until there's an Australian winner, I'm sure.
I feel like it'll be this year. Let's make it happen.
Great.
Obviously, you've spent a long time in kitchens, and as you just mentioned, it's very easy to access what other venues are doing around the world. So where do you go to, or how do you find inspiration for the dishes that you want to put on the menus at Key and Bennelong?
Yeah. Well, look, working at the very sort of top level of restaurants, I think you've really got to strive for something that has an originality or at least a uniqueness in approach. And that really, it only comes from years and years of knowledge and experience and accumulated, you know, tastes and memories. And, you know, so it comes down to a really personal sort of feeling of what is it that I believe would be a beautiful combination of flavors or a really interesting technique to put a different twist on that I haven't seen before. So a lot of experimentation. A lot of my inspiration actually comes from growing the produce and seeing, you know, well, this particular vegetable when it's really young is super tender, or when it flowers, the flowers are beautiful to eat, or the seed pods, or there's some aspect of the growing cycle that's not sort of taken advantage of. Like there's some beautiful pepita pumpkins that actually have a seed that's, they call it a naked seed, so it's not got a hard shell, and that's what pepitas actually are. They're a softer shell, but when I actually grew these pumpkins, I realized that when you harvest them and they're fresh and you don't dry the pepitas, they're actually delicious, you know, and they're very tender and sort of a little bit slippery. And so unless I grew it, I would have never known. And certainly unless you grow it, you can't have access to that ingredient. So that goes on the menu and forms an intricate part of the texture of a particular dish. So that then gives it something unique because there's not necessarily anyone doing that anywhere else in the world. So they're the things you search for.
Is there an item on the menu at Key that you can't take off the menu?
Well, there used to be.
I know that there used to be the snow egg, of course.
Yeah. And in the end, you know, I decided I just had to take it off because, you know, at the end of the day, you want to keep pushing boundaries. You want to keep being creative. So, you know, if I hadn't have taken it off, I wouldn't maybe have developed the white coral dessert, which is also stunning and beautiful. So, yeah, I try not to get too stuck down to signature dishes these days. I try and keep everything evolving. There's certain combinations, though. Like, you know, quite a few years ago, I worked with a particular cut of pork called the pig jowl, which is sort of like from the neck section, and we slowly cook it. It's sort of confit. It sort of takes, you know, 12 hours overnight to cook slowly, and then we smoke it, and then it's sort of warmed up in a beautiful sort of butter that's flavored with bay leaf and juniper. And that particular piece of meat is just so delicious. It has been on the menu for the last 12 years, but it's probably had, you know, at least that many evolutions. Every year there's something else I put with it. It might be different. Like at the moment, it is actually the maitake mushrooms that goes with the pig jowl. But over the years, there's been abalone served with it. There's been squid, ribbons. There's all sorts of combinations, sea scallops, things that are texturally interesting against that pig jowl. Well, then it'll be a new dish. So that's probably as close as it comes to not being able to take something off the menu.
You were born in Sydney. You've lived in Sydney for a long time. Are there any places that you like to eat, high end, low end, anywhere around the city?
Of course, of course, there is. I'm quite a big fan of yum cha. Still on my days off, I love a good yum cha. And there's been lots of different places over the years. There's a place in Chatswood called Mama Mulan that I go to regularly because I live on the north side. And, you know, I think Mr. Wong does a great yum cha as well. There's so many. There's some great restaurants that are doing really innovative things like Cafe Passy and Esther. Lots of sort of young chefs, sort of that model of a smaller restaurant with a smaller team, just pushing out really incredibly delicious food. You know, that's always exciting to go to those restaurants.
Well, watch out. We're now going to stalk you around Sydney coming to find you at Yum Cha. What else is coming up for you in 2024?
I've got a little bit of travel. Like I said, I'm doing a collab with my friend Sam in Vietnam, which will be wonderful. I'm also doing another collaboration in New Zealand, which I'm looking forward to. A little bit of travel. I'd like my son, I said when he was 21, we'll go and do a road trip in America, and he loves jazz and I love jazz, and so we're probably going down to New Orleans and the deep south of America and do a bit of a road trip. So that's going to be that's a personal fun thing that's happening. As far as professionally, the key in Benelong are really, you know, keep me incredibly busy. I do a bit of work for different people. I do a little bit of consultation and things like that. And I've been working as an ambassador with Lark Whiskey recently. So, a few little projects on the boil. And then I've got my farm down in Tasmania. So I keep pretty busy.
Now, you kind of hinted right at the beginning of this recording of retiring. That isn't anytime soon, is it?
No, I don't think so. I really, actually, during COVID, when the restaurant was closed, we closed for two periods of 6 months, and I realized how much I missed the business. I missed the creativity, and so the idea of actually just retiring and not working in this business, I can't see that for quite a few years to come. It'd be hard, I think, getting around the kitchen at, 70, but I'm a fair way from that. So it's, no time soon, but I really, I have the idea of maybe one day, being able to spend a bit more time down in Tasmania. So something may come of that at some stage in the next few years, but we'll see.
That's music to our ears. Please stay at the Pass where we can find you at Key and Benelong. Thank you so much for coming in to the podcast, and we better let you get back.
All right, absolutely.
You've got a busy night ahead.
It's been a pleasure. Yep, a better run.
That's all we have time for today, but we'll be back on Thursday with this week's news and recommendations.